This week on Decentralize, Torsten Hoffman of Bitcoin and of money as we know it, copyright law and remix culture, and platforms versus protocols.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
Every now and then on Decentralized, we like to have our segment, What's Pissing Us Off This Week? And I think one of the things we're often pissed off by is intellectual property on the show, and we talk about it quite consistently. But sometimes it shows up in the popular culture and in the popular conversation. That's one of the things Eric pointed out to me. That's been an article at NPR. It's actually I've seen circulated multiple times, but it always comes back because it's such a great example of something to be pissed off by copyright, which is Happy Birthday. Tell us about that, Eric.
So you know when you go into a restaurant and you celebrate, you know, your birthday, you're taking a buddy of yours out for dinner, or, you know, it's maybe it's your birthday, and, you know, you kind of whisper to the hostess or the waiter that or the waitress or whatever that, you know, hey, it's my friend's birthday here. And every restaurant has, like, this totally different, like, take on it. They all sing, like, these weird, kooky songs that, like, it's like happy birthday, dot, and it's not even like the real happy birthday song. It's like their own weird twist on it. The reason for that is exactly what this article was pointing out, is that there's actually an outstanding copyright on the happy birthday song. So you technically are violating copyright law if you record yourself singing happy birthday, right? You are in violation of copyright, technically. Imagine if you were doing just a voice recording and sending it over, I don't know, Voxer or WhatsApp, you doing the act of recording that and sending it over Voxer or WhatsApp is actually in violation of this copyright. And I, frankly, I just found this absurd. And the history behind it is really interesting. But the fact that, you know, nobody, it's like a shared cultural resource at this point, this happy birthday song. And the fact that law is preventing us from, you know, spreading culture and sharing in a ritual is sort of ridiculous. Like, this is sort of an intrinsic idea for human interaction. And here we've found ourselves somehow in a society where it's actually not, it's against the law, and we could potentially be fined or put in jail for singing a song. It's kind of ridiculous, right?
Not only ridiculous, but the one thing that pisses us off this week on Decentralized. So, but I guess to clarify on one point, I think this article is basically talking about commercial uses, and generally copyright does apply mostly to that. So if you're just singing, no worries, everyone, if you're just singing happy birthday, the guys aren't going to come put a hood on your head or anything and carry you off. So you don't have to worry about that. But you do have to worry about it if you're using it in any kind of commercial context. And commercial context can be treated very broadly by the law. If you put something on the web, essentially, that has any kind of connection maybe to advertising revenue or whatever, you're kind of towing that very gray line, the line that's been gray, especially since kind of the advent of digital content, for one thing, and really always, as long as copyright trolls have existed. But I'm definitely as concerned, I think, as you, Eric, and especially as it relates to sort of the remix culture, to use a term which is kind of bandied about a lot in this space, that has made Happy Birthday what it is. This article talks from NPR about how it's gone through so many iterations, how, like, the song itself actually came from a tune that was in the public domain from a song called Good Morning to All. And it was just slowly adapted over time to become the song it is. And like you said, you know, in every restaurant you hear a different version of the song. In movies, they do different versions of the songs. They reference a version of the song used in the Disney movie, An Emperor's New Groove. And there, you know, a lot of that so actually go around the copyright restrictions on using the song. I mean, it's more, for one thing, kind of prohibitively expensive to get permission to use these things. So I don't think most people have had that issue with this song so far. We're only really just now kind of digging up the fact that it is still under copyright. But yeah, I mean, just imagine sort of what if this law had been applied so consistently from its beginning? Would we have all these magnificent, annoying, exuberant versions of Happy Birthday we get sung to us every time we go out to eat?
So that's who's to blame for that annoyance? I mean, to be fair, I find Happy Birthday just as annoying. It's like, I came here to eat, not to listen to everyone sing. But this is stupid, and I also think it's something that really was never... I mean, I heard this existed for about a decade, you know, me being a music nerd, and I have heard it's loosely enforced on broadcast media, So if you're in a big movie and it sells millions at the box office or whatever, then they're going to go after you. But if you're Joe's family restaurant and your staff sings it, unless, obviously, how are they going to find that out unless they have someone there that's going to report it? I think it's one of those little things that there really hasn't been to a reason to enforce it for a long time, because, you know, if this was a copyrighted song, it's been copyrighted for a long time. And it also, it sounds, from the way you described it, from what I've heard too, it's a folk song. It's changed over time, but whatever, we can get into that later. But still, I think the application of it in broadcast media is really what they're clamping down on. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just kind of saying that's really what it's coming down to. And I think a lot of these corporations have attorneys who want to protect them and say, you better not use that, they'll sue you. And they think, oh, they'll sue us, so let's write a new song. And then now we have to hear them clap at the Mexican restaurant and sing an annoying song, and I just get a headache. So for all that being said, thanks a lot. I have to be the negative Norman, but thanks to the people, the copyright trolls that existed decades ago to protect this song. You've ruined everything.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. It's like you're talking about perfect enforcement versus non-perfect enforcement, and this idea that, you know, because it's technically illegal to do these things, doesn't mean that, you know, people aren't going to do it. Is it people who don't realize that it's against the law are going to do it, and B, people don't think that they're going to get, you know, this law enforced against them, right? And you know, you're right. You know, they're only going to go after the big players here for the time being. But the fact that there is a law that they can hold over your head, this is the type of thing, actually, that, you know, when you get brought in for something that they can't quite pin you on, this is what they hold over your head to say, hey, we have this video of you performing this law. And it gets tacked on as like an additional $50,000 fine in addition to other crimes that you've committed that they can't quite pin on you.
I thought it was planting drugs on you.
Well, I mean, yes, that's certainly a more overt way. But, I mean, just because we don't have perfect enforcement of law doesn't mean that it's acceptable to have an unjust law in place. And frankly, I mean, this whole thing is just a symptom of an unjust legal system. Like, it's completely absurd. In an ideal environment, the only laws that would be written would be contractual. In a sub-ideal environment, the only laws that would be written would be ones that applied equally to everyone. So it didn't matter what size you were, it applied equally to you. It's the same, it works in both directions, right? So we want to have equal enforcement of law, not arbitrary size-based enforcement.
I think it's a fair point, Eric, and it's definitely something which this should concern people, as should really all copyright law. I mean, it's not immediately evident in enforcement. Obviously, if you're just sort of an average Joe adapting this song for maybe a YouTube video you're putting up, a lot of people on YouTube manage to fly under the radar if they're posting copyrighted content. And that's something to celebrate, I think. But like you said, obviously, it does reflect the ultimately arbitrary nature of legislation. But I think there are emerging a number of ways for people to, you know, who don't necessarily have the savvy to go on BitTorrent and, you know, seed a BitTorrent file and release that. People who want to download it sort of directly. There are alternatives with licensing and things like that. We use Creative Commons on our podcast, and we basically remove as many of the rights as we possibly can on all of our platforms. So it's with Creative Commons, with Creative Commons Zero, which is just basically like putting it into the public domain as a creator. I see a lot of good artists doing that. One of the sites I see a lot, which I use a lot for social media posts or for design work, and I know a lot of people who do as well, is unsplash.com, which is just a site, like a portfolio of like absolutely beautiful photos that are basically like stock photos but actually good, and all of them are released under Creative Commons Zero, so there's no attribution required, there's no nothing required. It's basically do whatever you want, and it's really cool to see artists doing that. And ironically, for Unsplash as an example, they've seen like an explosion of people using their content. Like if you go on a site like Medium, everyone uses Unsplash's photos because there are no restrictions attached to it. We're living in such a really fast-paced world where no one wants to take time, and, you know, rightly so. No one wants to go and read and agree to a shrink wrap license. So it's definitely encouraging to see some alternatives emerging.
Yeah, and the one thing I wanted to follow up on when you were talking about a content that squeaks through YouTube's filters, what they often do is they cut off the sides of a video, right? Maybe me doing this, like I'm some hipster director, isn't the best way to prove this, but it really is something where they cut off the sides of it, which is where the tag is located, and that way it's not tagged. So you won't be getting the full frame of it, but that's how a lot of it squeaks by. And then some of it just isn't tagged if it's from like a VHS rip or something, you know. So there are ways that it can happen, but you know, as convenient as those other methods are to get video, none of them are as convenient as YouTube. And that's really, I think, the answer there. And it's going to be cool to get something that kind of melds the two so we can have a freer content distribution system.
You know, I've also heard people actually with songs and things like that, they'll change the RPM of the. And I'm not giving legal counsel on how you should upload your videos or if you should. Decentralized listeners, we encourage everyone to abide by the law, which is not always legislation. In fact, it rarely is. But so take my double meaning for what it is there. The whole content question is really interesting, and it's something we're very concerned with and tied up with the podcast. As Eric has mentioned before, we not only are we kind of using those alternative licenses, we're releasing stuff through BitTorrent and stuff, but one of the things I was interested in talking about with y'all, because you're writers as well as podcasters in your own right, is the tools you use for distributing your written content, the platforms you like, why you think they're important or valuable, and which maybe more decentralized ones you're seeing coming up that you might be interested in. So, I mean, you have Tumblr out there. I know Tony's a big fan of that. You have Medium, which I'm a huge fan of.
I like LiveJournal more than Tumblr, actually, to be fair. Let's be honest. I love LiveJournal. But continue, James. I just wanted to insert that when you said that about Tumblr. I was waiting for you to say LiveJournal, and I was like, what? No.
I'm not familiar with LiveJournal, actually. Tell me about it.
Ooh, you're young. LiveJournal was like the first one that got really big of all these, not what I now call social media, and it was just that. It was very basic but very customizable. The whole e-drama community around Encyclopedia Dramatica kind of spawned around that community that kind of merged over into 4chan and Reddit to some degree. But, yeah, it just was very easy, very simple. I have one. It's private for a reason. You know, and I don't mean that to you guys, I mean that to anyone. It's just literally I'm the only one that sees it, and it's actually not even hosted online. But it's such a cool platform that really there were so many people that used it, but MySpace made it so it's easier to customize, which unfortunately really was the dagger that killed them because it was too customizable and people that didn't know how to do things were doing things they shouldn't be doing. And to me, everyone kind of says it was Friendster, but I don't ever remember knowing anyone that used Friendster. I knew a lot of people that used LiveJournal, a lot.
You're right, Tony. I must be young. I've never heard of. I've really only heard of Friendster a few times in any context. But it's an interesting question. We're like, it's probably because there's such a quick and rapid creative destruction and disruption of these platforms that makes this feel so interesting. Because I do think we're seeing a change. My theory would be, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, is that we're moving away from, not necessarily moving away from the personal blog, like the WordPress site or the Blogger site or whatever, because that's still going very strong and there's still a lot of good blogs out there. But we are moving toward platforms and especially like networked platforms. So if you look at Tumblr, if you look at Medium, when you create a site there, and to some extent WordPress as well, this is true, WordPress.com, you have a network of people using the same platform, also creating content which can be linked, which can be found through tags and searches, which has a certain kind of like SEO of its own to it, especially with Medium. And this is where I've had the most of my experience with putting content out there. And I'll address LinkedIn as well in a second, because I actually really like LinkedIn's content section. But with Medium, I mean, it's very different from stuff you see on things like Facebook and even to some extent Twitter, and that it's really curated, but not in a way that is kind of biased by a certain algorithm. So with Facebook, obviously, you know, only like 5% of your friends see your posts. I just made up that figure completely, but it's certainly not 100%, and a lot of people complained about that. But with Medium, it's I've definitely found it to be a very useful platform and one where if you write good stuff and you know use the appropriate good title, appealing image, preferably from unsplash.com because there's no copyright, and put it in the right place, people will find it. And it's really cool to see something like that. And I think to see it because there is that network there of people looking for valuable writing. And it tends to be really valuable. I mean, you see a lot of entrepreneurs and artists and just the kind of people you really want to be communicating with there.
Well, what we're seeing, so the internet sort of disrupted a lot of traditional content distribution models. So I always like to refer to the music industry and the existence of a record label. So a record label is a curator of sorts, an aggregator even. They let certain people into their label, and they carefully select the people that they choose to invite on board. And then their job is basically to get promotion for their artists. It's a distribution channel. They sell the records. They take them to the record stores. They help do promotions. They connect people. So the internet kind of came in like a hot knife through butter and suddenly made it so that literally every person who had internet access could publish content. And this we're only really in the past few years starting to see like the real repercussions of this in terms of like the newspaper industry, the music industry, like anything that relied on an existing publishing model, including like writing of books and articles and essays and things like that. These business models had to fundamentally change, and we're only just now in the past few years seeing these models emerge where something like aggregation and curation makes sense again. Because the signal-to-noise ratio has changed so much. There's so much content out there. And I would urge caution here. These platforms, Medium, I mean, WordPress was probably really a really good first mover here. Once social networks, and I put this in quotes because I'm describing the digital iteration of a social network here, not the graph theory representation. But once the digital representation of a social network emerged, that became your content channel, your distribution partner. And anything that could latch onto that content distribution platform became very successful very quickly. And it took people years to figure out exactly what the right way of latching onto those channel partners are. But but here's the problem. It's exactly the same model as what we had before. And it does not take advantage of the natural network process, the sort of distributed content idea. And what we're becoming amenable to, what we're becoming agreeable to very slowly. It's like we're frogs in the pot, and the water is slowly coming to a boil. We don't even notice that what's happening is the world is returning to this centralized model again. We have to be very resistant to plugging into these networks solely for the convenience factor. Otherwise, we're going to end up as a boiled frog in a pot again. We need to take this one, maybe once in a lifetime, maybe once in an eon opportunity to really fully adopt technologies that encourage true, flat, democratic structures where the content is self-organizing and not curated by some algorithm, let alone by some human who's individually like choosing what type of content is allowed to be posted. And that's because that is the dangerous road and the dangerous path to go down. Once you get into the point of allowing an algorithm or a person to choose what is permissible and what is not, then you immediately are therefore introducing the opportunity for censorship. And furthermore, what follows on after that is power abuse and suppression and elimination of truly free speech. So it really is a very important time right now, a very critical time for people to focus on making sure we build platforms that strongly enforce equality and do not have any centralization in any capacity.
You know, I want to respond a little bit or go into more detail about something you said about the beginning of your last phrase, where you were talking about the different social networks of themselves and how they're becoming more centralized. And just how, if you take a step back, and this has nothing to do with censorship, but this has a lot to do, I guess it has a little bit to do with censorship and moderation, I should say. I changed my quote there. But what happened is on the internet, content became something where you're on Twitter, you're on Facebook, and yeah, they're really easy platforms for anyone to use, which is goal number one. What the problem with that is it's much harder to find people that share topics that you value. Yes, there's Facebook groups, but are they as efficient as maybe a 10-year-old message board about a topic? Probably not. My favorite places on the net are not my Facebook page. They are forums. They are me, lurking and finding out information about whatever it may be, because quite often those, unless there's some kind of you know, raid happening on the board or something, they really are on topic and the moderators legitimately care. I'm not saying that a system without moderators wouldn't be better, but what I'm saying is those moderators care because of the platform, the community they build. And what you're seeing is these get used less and less. People are less likely to be introduced to them. They're less likely to use them. And that's sad because I read an awesome piece about the I'm Lonely, Will Anyone Speak to Me thread, which is about 11 years old now, which makes me just feel old as hell. This was on a video codec message board, and it became kind of this meme, and it was right before the social media boom happened. And this forum just showed how the most random people would kind of find this and say, I'm lonely too. It wasn't something where you immediately connected with all your followers and friends. And, you know, it's interesting. And I think it's made the internet a lot less fun, honestly. I had way more fun on the internet 15 years ago than I do now. Maybe I'm just getting old and I'm like the kids nowadays. You know, I don't know. But it does seem that the more it does get more centralized, the less fun it gets. And that's something I care about because I like having fun.
Oh, man, I feel like I've just been scolded by my elders. I think you both have really great points. I love it. And we've talked about bulletin boards on this show before, actually, which I know is kind of an earlier iteration of this, which is more decentralized. And it does seem like in some ways, even though we're kind of getting these platforms, we're also seeing alternatives in more protocol-oriented things. And I'm actually referring a little bit to an article which is on TechDirt, a great publication, a great blog on copyright, actually, which covers intellectual property issues a lot. They actually posted something in response to a lot of the controversy that's going on Reddit right now, with some of the censorship questions and with recent resignation of the CEO, and kind of this malaise about the future of Reddit. The author was suggesting that we actually return, or we look toward protocols, not toward platforms, which I thought was a good way of following up on Eric's point at the end there, that platforms do tend to be very central things. And so in the best of cases, they're just sort of marketplaces where people meet. In other cases, they kind of do take on the more active role of a central organizer of content, which sounds very suspicious to central planner of content, which sounds very suspicious to Soviet hellscape of literary blankness and despair, which we don't want, of course. And one of the things, I guess, which maybe bulletin board systems point toward, which that kind of like freewheeling legendary Wild West of the early internet points toward, is that when you just had basic protocols for communication and relaying data from person to person, you did have a lot more freedom and a lot more like really interesting things result. Some of those interesting things happen to be platforms, people, you know, collaborating on software and stuff like that, but the protocols themselves seem to be really basic to this. So the recommendation of the article was not to get rid of platforms, but to basically have protocols that were, you know, universally interoperable. So if I don't like Reddit anymore, I can basically go using the same kind of protocol to any other platform that'll have me. So the platforms do exist in a way to provide like voluntary or more voluntary than they are curation, but not censorship. You always have kind of the exit option. I wanted to sort of hear your thoughts on this, guys. What do you see this happening? Do you see this as a valuable thing? And do you see any examples out there right now of projects that are kind of taking the protocol idea and transforming the way we view platforms?
Yeah, so the Reddit conversation is really interesting, and I think it plays into this platforms versus protocols issue, and sort of to the earlier point that we talked about, that we have to move towards truly decentralized systems. Look, online communities and forums, there's a law. I forget what the actual name of the law is, but it's a description of, you know, the longer time goes on an internet forum or an online discussion place, the closer probability comes to one, to the moderators or the admins being compared to Hitler in terms of dictators.
Godwin's law. It's called Godwin's law. I just looked it up, but I was familiar with it.
Sorry. Godwin's law. Okay, so me being an operator of one of the biggest online writing forums for over 10 years now, I think this is actually our 10-year anniversary, and having, you know, millions of viewers, you know, come through our site constantly, you know, I've suffered from this. And the problem with any centralized platform like Facebook, Reddit, Twitter, any of these platforms, I mean, we can even talk about WordPress and Medium, is that there is an authority, and as much as you want to delude yourselves into thinking that it is a democratic platform and good content sort of bubbles to the top. The reality is that these are not democratic processes at all. They're not even social. At best, they're weak dictatorships that are run by the operators of that platform. So this article really hits home for me because protocols are the only way to eliminate the problem of having authority or a dictatorship or the management or oversight of something being central. It is the only way that we can form a peer-to-peer dialogue where we are broadcasting messages and receiving messages in a way that doesn't rely on some sort of central facilitator. Because anytime you have a central facilitator, there is the opportunity for them to not only influence and choose what they facilitate, but also to manipulate and control it and even change it based on your original contexts. I've actually had cases where, I've provided posted content to specific locations online, trying to communicate with perhaps some former classmates. And literally what happened is the people who operate that changed my sentences because they didn't like what I wrote. So they changed the context of everything that I said. And that is the type of manipulation that you allow for when you have any centralized facilitator of communication or information transit. And this is exactly what happens with, in the case of Reddit very recently. You have an entire community that has developed and was birthed from the internet with the feeling, this sort of expectation, because the early facilitators of that platform were very internet friendly. They were very democratic. They wanted to support the community. They wanted it to be a community homegrown thing. But over time, and this is great evidence in support of this theory, over time it became this place where content was starting to get a little bit, frictionful, and hot button issues would be raised. There was even hate speech on the platform. And so eventually, and this happened several times over the past year, ranging from, what we called the fappening, which is where a bunch of private celebrity photos got shared online, and a lot of them contained very explicit content, ranging all the way to the recent ousting of Ellen Pao, the CEO, or the appointed CEO of Reddit, and the returning of some of the original founding members. It slowly goes down this decline because power aggregates and it centralizes and it slowly influences. And this utopian ideal of a centrally managed community where everything is perfect fairies and unicorns is absurd. No matter what happens, you will always end up in the same place where the owners of the platform have to make a decision about what type of content they want to allow on their site. Through their medium, whatever it is, it comes down to the point where they have to make a decision, and they can either A, weigh on the side of free speech and simply allow any content, which many people on Reddit tried to do within the administration, or they can take the other road and start saying this type of content is not allowed, and it's a very difficult dialogue to have, and the only solution is simply to eliminate the central point of authority and let people as individuals decide what they choose to consume and what they don't want to consume. And the only way to do that is through building a protocol for exchange of messages and content, not relying on a medium.com or a facebook.com to facilitate that for you.
I think that's well said, Eric, and it's something, you make good points. I guess I sort of disagree a little bit on maybe the analogy of dictatorship for Medium, or WordPress, which is really has very much open source mentality to it, but yeah, ultimately you're right. I guess sort of that these platforms, they with any kind of power tends to corrupt a little bit, and it does seem, like you said, it seems innocent at first, but it kind of gets to the point where you do have to make that hard call as a business owner, as a platform operator, of what to allow on and what to not allow. So I think ideally, it'd be really interesting to see what projects emerge to fill this need. Not necessarily, I guess on my perspective, getting rid of all platforms, but making the platforms far more competitive with each other, taking away some of the power they have by giving people pretty much a good universal, which they already have universal, like basic protocols of the web to communicate, but more protocols for social media oriented things. And one of the things I guess to mention here would be the project called Twister, which is one of the first blockchain-based and BitTorrent-based apps I ever encountered about a year ago, which is a decentralized Twitter based on the Bitcoin blockchain. Projects like that, and there are quite a few out there. There have even been proposed alternatives to Reddit that are already, you know, have been talked about by VCs, by previous guests on the show. It seems to be a very, very promising space.
I'd also like to point out something called Ether, getether.net, A-E-T-H-E-R. We'll share the link in the show notes. There are existing protocols out there. They just aren't widely adopted yet. And I think that's partially because people just don't know about them. And I think that's where we sort of should be coming in, is pointing out these projects and let, may the best protocol win, right? Today we're joined by Torsten Hoffmann, who is the producer and director of the new award-winning documentary, Bitcoin, The End of Money as We Know It. Torsten, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
All right, so first things first, what made you decide to make this film?
Well, Bitcoin is a complex topic, and it's hard to get the message across and the whole thing across in just one article that people might read in the New York Times. So I think it's a perfect topic for a TV documentary, and we ended up doing it in 60 minutes. So it's basically a 60-minute crash course into money and Bitcoin.
So, Torsten, this is essentially not just a documentary about Bitcoin, but also about monetary history. How did you decide to kind of approach it this way to take on this topic particularly?
Yeah, that was actually, that changed. So I wanted to make a film about Bitcoin, but I then, starting to write it, realized that we can't just jump right in. We would lose people. So we just had to start all the way in the beginning with the history of money, the gold coins, the governments that started to, you know, collect taxes and clip off those gold coins and things like that, because only then, or even inflation. I mean, that's a very important one, obviously, for Bitcoin. So even if people know what the problem is with our fiat money, then they kind of get what the difference is in Bitcoin. So I think that was, yeah, a learning process for me along the way. And we spent about half of the film talking about money and banks and finance, and the other half about Bitcoin.
One of the things we always like to ask about guests that are on have something to do with a project directly involving the Bitcoin blockchain is, how did you first discover Bitcoin?
So like many people, I heard about it two or three times and dismissed it and just kind of shrugged it off and laughed at it. But once I studied a bit more, I think only an hour maybe, it completely caught me. And maybe, you know, you guys changed your careers or started a podcast, or, you know, some people write a book or blog. And for me, it was making a film about it. So similar to many others I think you've probably had on the show.
So what is it that you learned in the process of making this film? Was there any surprises that you learned about Bitcoin or the ecosystem in general?
A few things. So, I mean, the history of money wasn't really my area of expertise. So I did learn a lot researching that particular part of the story. But in terms of Bitcoin, what I was surprised about, you know, in the beginning, people talk about those libertarian ideas and, you know, how freedom is so important and all these things. And at the beginning, I thought that's kind of bullshit, right? I thought that's it doesn't matter. It's a technology and it's money. And the more I kind of got into this space and talked to more and more people, Roger Ver is a good example, the more I realized how bad an idea it is to have governments or banks in control of our money. So this libertarian or that freedom aspect of it actually does make a lot of sense to me. So that's something I changed my mind about.
So maybe for our listeners who haven't seen the movie yet, and we definitely recommend it, or I would, having seen it, could you explain a little bit sort of why you think the libertarian critique of maybe central banking has some merit, why you think Bitcoin sort of plays a role in that change in monetary history, a little teaser kind of the thrust of the movie, and especially toward monetary theory and history?
Yeah, a few things come to mind. So I think most people don't realize that the Fed is actually not a government agency or like a government department. It's owned by private banks, and that is one thing, and maybe that's bad enough. But if you realize that our money today is created by debt, so that means if the U.S. government goes much more into debt, they sell those bonds, the same banks that own the Fed benefit from having more debt. So basically, the whole system is kind of set up to create more and more money. And that, of course, turns into inflation down the road. So I think that is something we try to have a punchy little paragraph or chapter in our film about, like those charts of how inflation, you know, affects money. So that would be one. Another one, let me think. Yeah, like even the idea of how paper money was actually first invented or first came about. It was really about people agreeing that this paper had value because somebody else would you know, exchange it and agree to the person that issues this can be trusted, so therefore his paper has value. And I think that is particularly important if you later look into Bitcoin, how value is created.
And to further that a little bit, since the documentary is a lot about monetary history and about Bitcoin, obviously, what sources or experts, you know, off-screen or on-screen, did you speak with or consult with to kind of, you know, guide where you were going with this?
So many different things. So, I mean, I have a big bookshelf behind me, and I kind of studied a finance MBA as well. But we had many top experts on camera and off camera. So economists like Jeffrey Tucker, Roger Ver, and all these kind of Bitcoin gurus, of course, but also some skeptics. And I think, or I hope at least, that this is not too much of a fanboy film. I hope it's not like too one-sided. I mean, obviously, I'm a big Bitcoin believer and fan, but for the mainstream audience, I think it's important to also have the other side of the coin, if you will. So there are some people saying, yeah, okay, this Bitcoin thing is an interesting idea, but you know, one, two, three things to consider here. So we try to keep a balance. It's hard because it's so hard to find people who understand Bitcoin and still criticize it. As you know, it's hard to find those people.
So let's unwrap that just a little bit. You know, it sounds like there are still some critics who may understand it. Was there some sort of merit to the arguments that they had against Bitcoin, or perhaps even a common thread that caused them to oppose Bitcoin despite the fact that they understood it?
So we have a few of those uneducated critics that say, oh, this is a scam, this is a Ponzi scheme, this is too volatile, you know. And I mean, volatility could be, I guess it has some merit. The criticism of Bitcoin being volatile, you could spin it both ways, right? It's good and bad, or maybe it doesn't matter. But I think one criticism that I actually do think has a lot of merit is, at the moment, most people don't really spend Bitcoin. So most people, maybe that's not you and me, but most people that know about Bitcoin, they might have bought a few and just to keep it, and with the idea of saving it for 5 years, 10 years, and then it will be worth much, much more. And so if that's the case, and you know, there might be a good investment case for that, but if that's the case, it's not really a currency, right? It's an asset. It's a speculative thing. And I think it's fair to say that Bitcoin has yet to develop into a real global currency, into an internet currency, or I think that's fair.
So one of the great illustrations in the film, there were two actually that caught my eye the most. Was one, the high-fiving graphic between the bank and the Federal Reserve. I laughed at that. I really enjoyed it, the little high-five of the institutions. But the other one was actually like more of a metaphor, more of an illustration drawing from history. You talked about how early automobiles had flagmen who actually had to go out and run out before the vehicle and warn people of the coming dangerous automobile innovation. And you obviously made the comparison there to Bitcoin being, you know, a little bit feared, a little bit misunderstood, but I'm wondering if you could kind of explain that again to listeners who maybe haven't seen it yet, just to kind of entice them. It's a fascinating little snippet from history.
Yeah, I agree. That's one of my favorite parts as well. It's kind of like right in the middle of the film. So we talk about money and the history of banks and things like that, and then how to get into that Bitcoin chapter. So there's like a little 5-minute segment which we call innovation, and I believe it opens with a quote saying that, oh, the only useful things that banks have ever invented was the ATM machine or something like that. It's a quote by the former Fed chairman saying that, oh, this industry is traditionally not very innovative. But the point here that you just described is new technologies are always like ridiculed, laughed at, or people who are in power, people who stand to lose most from that new technology, are always trying to break it, to slow it down, to flag it down. And the automobile is just so perfect because it was literally flagged down by a flagman, and it was slowed down literally because cars were not allowed to go faster than 4 miles an hour. So the whole point of an automobile was like kind of taken away. And looking at the internet at the beginning was only about child pornography and all these internet viruses, right? Nobody could see, or some people who criticized it couldn't see the benefits from it. And I think we see the same thing with Bitcoin, and it will be an interesting battle how it will turn out, right?
Absolutely. Continue. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's fine. So it sounds like you're crafting a narrative with this film, and I really like this idea that you explain the history and then have a section in the middle that sort of pivots you into that next chapter. What do you think the role of education is when it comes to the adoption of this technology? And furthermore, do you think that people are ever really going to care how their money works?
Yeah. So the first comment, well, I obviously think education is super, super important, and my way to do it is to make a film, and I hope that maybe one day the film will get on Netflix, hopefully next week will be on iTunes and Amazon, so hope a lot of new people that will not listen to your podcast and not buy a Bitcoin book, but maybe they'll find the movie. The second question... I don't know. What do you think? What's your take on that?
I'm often worried that the fact that people are so complacent, and I'm really hoping that films like this get exposure to ideas that people wouldn't have otherwise seen. And I think that's one of the reasons why filmmaking is such a powerful technology. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in filmmaking and what brought you to this specific art?
Mm-hmm. Jumping back to what you just said, I fully agree with you. Maybe on top of that, things like the euro crisis in Greece, right, where people suddenly can't access their money, or some other scam going on with the next investment bank paying $1 billion in penalties for doing some shady scheme. I think all this helps a little, but you're probably right. I mean, people take money for granted. So yeah. Yeah, let's see. But in terms of my background, so I've been actually in the media industry for 12 years, I think now, buying and selling documentaries. So I'm the guy who basically takes 10 documentaries to Netflix or to Deutsche Telekom or clients all around the world and try to sell them or try to license them documentaries. And so this is actually the first one that I create myself. So after working with filmmakers for 10 years on the business side, this is the first time I'm the creative person behind it. But obviously we've had a team of highly experienced people who helped me in the editing room and helped me with shooting the interviews and things like that.
That's really cool. It's really exciting to kind of create it for the first time. And actually, we kind of wanted to shift gears and ask you a little bit in detail about the filmmaking process for our listeners, if you'd be willing. So the first question, I guess, would be, what are kind of the first steps you take when you go to make a documentary? And like, how do you go just from zero to making a film happen? Maybe just start with the first few steps and kind of describe what that process really looked like, as in detail as you'd like, because I think... we probably have a lot of people in our audience who are interested in creating things, interested in kind of expressing ideas like this through creative arts.
Hmm. Good question. So I don't think there's one definitive answer or one cookbook, so to speak. But for me, and that might be very interesting for your audience, I think it was a very iterative process, like a startup, right? So I didn't go onto Kickstarter and say, this is my idea. No, I actually did, I think the Miami shoot, that was our first shoot. I did that one, possibly two shoots before I even, really started that project. So I had lots of material already. I knew there's a story there. Then we did a Kickstarter, and the Kickstarter was not to fully fund the film. It was never meant to be, but it maybe covers maybe 20% of the budget. But it kind of was another step, a proof of concept, right? So people are interested in the idea. People are willing to pre-buy the DVDs and things like that. And then, you film more, you spend a lot of money, a lot of time. time, and you work on it. And another like milestones for me was a film festival. So there were like submission date. Oh, we have to submit to this film festival on that date. So we have to get like a 30-minute version of the film ready, even though it's not perfect yet. And yeah, we kept working on it and working on it. And finally, after 2 years now almost, it's done. But I constructed it in a way, and that's maybe also a suggestion for everybody. Do not make a film that's like so dependent on the current day or on the current exchange rate or on the latest scandal, because by the time your film is out, on Netflix, let's say, it's going to be out there for 2 years, and so I designed the film in a way that it's still as attractive or as important in 2 years' time, right? So there's nothing too current about it.
Since you were just mentioning that you purchased and sold documentaries, what maybe are some documentaries you would recommend that really influenced you, or even that you just enjoyed that maybe not everyone has seen or heard about?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The one standout in recent time was Citizen 4, the award-winning documentary. I mean, it's just so scary, and it's such an important point. And you know, I'm just a beginner and a rookie in this game, but watching something like Citizen 4, that's a film that can really change the world and change behaviors all around the world. And certainly, there's a few others. I mean, the big one is of course the climate change one 10 years ago that Al Gore did, Inconvenient Truth. Those kind of films do inspire me because they do create a kind of a cultural change, and that's very inspiring.
So one of the things we like to talk about, and one of the things we're actually going to be talking about in our talk segment this time, is intellectual property, intellectual content, and copyright. So I noticed that you decided to distribute this film on BitTorrent. We'll talk about that in a bit. But how did you get through the process of actually acquiring the content and the permission to use the things that you did in the film?
Yeah, and that's a very tricky point. I've actually met other Bitcoin filmmakers who were a little bit not diligent enough with it. Just to give you an idea, I had a 4-second or 5-second snippet from CNBC, I believe it was, a Warren Buffett quote, and where Warren Buffett basically said, "Oh, Bitcoin is a mirage," right? That famous quote. But that 5 seconds would have cost me $2,000 to license the rights. So, and I mean, I spent a lot of money on it, but I can't spend $2,000 for 5 seconds, right? So what we did in this case, we still use that quote, but we use a picture of him and in a written quote, right? But a lot of Bloomberg footage, a lot of C-SPAN footage. We need to get the proper paperwork, and it's very time-consuming, tedious work, and sometimes also quite expensive. So, yeah, very tough. Fortunately, the Bitcoin crowd was actually very helpful. So, you know, we have a lot of footage of Bitcoin ATMs and and those kind of footage that we just got for free, right? Those startup Bitcoin startups, they want the exposure, so they sent me screenshots of their wallets and their software and all that. So that was easy. But yeah, overall, I think we spent probably $10,000 just on footage, right? Then you had another question. You were going to ask me about BitTorrent later, yeah.
Well, I do have a follow-up, and sort of as you were describing it, something that I found interesting was that the people that wanted to actually grow were willing to give you their content and were very agreeable. The people that were just trying to defend their entrenched, you know, sort of authority, that they're the ones who were fighting you. I found that very interesting. But furthermore, I'm kind of curious. Wouldn't the quote, the example that you gave, does that not fall under the fair use clause?
So my co-director is a television professional for 20 years. He's won many awards, and we were discussing and debating this over and over and over again. And for example, if you make fun of a quote and you contextualize it or comment on it, you would probably get away with it. You're right. But in our case, it was really like an opening quote for a new chapter. So it wouldn't really work like that. And we have a little bit of Wall Street footage, right? Where we just need it to cover space when we talk about Wall Street. And so it's beautiful shots of Wall Street and this and this. So we're just using it as eye candy. So we can't claim a fair use on that. But it's a very interesting topic, and I can assure you there's many people getting sued for not doing their homework. And to be fair though, some of this footage is being produced by professionals. They stand out in Wall Street and wait for the Lehman Brothers executive to leave with their boxes, right? And I mean, they have to get paid eventually. So I mean, it is a legitimate business to do footage sales.
It's really fascinating to see how this is made, because it's such a part of kind of the media we consume. As we see the images of Wall Street and everything, we never really wonder how it's made. And I guess one of the things I'd like to follow up on that question was, what are some of the other challenges, I guess, of making an independent film, of bootstrapping a project like this, and how did you find creative ways of overcoming them?
So number one challenge is money, obviously. I mean, you can nowadays, you guys know this, you could probably do a Bitcoin documentary for free just with interviewing people on Google Hangouts, and completely fine. But that's not a television ready product at the end of the day. So we spend maybe $80,000 to $100,000 in total, which is very expensive if you compare it to a low end, but it's also very cheap if you compare it to a proper TV documentary that takes up 25 times as much sometimes. Some of the documentaries that I represent in the wildlife space are multi-million dollar productions. So, I mean, it's always, you have to find your middle ground. And I can tell you, I'm still struggling making back that money. So even though you could say, well, we're very successful, we've won awards, everybody knows about our film, I haven't even recovered 10% of the budget yet. So, I mean, that is, I think, the main challenge. Other than that, maybe just like a little anecdote, it's so hard to find Bitcoin critics to be in front of the camera. So we had this one famous guy, what's his nickname is Professor Bitcoin or Bitcoin. Maybe you've heard of him. He's all over the news always, like making fun of Bitcoin. So we've had an appointment booked with him, and then his lawyer in the last minute pulled out and said, oh no, my lawyers advised me not to make a television documentary with you guys. So it's hard. It's hard to find those critics, and that's why it's hard to do a completely balanced view. But I mean, how do you balance something? I mean, my job is to tell the truth and to tell how does Bitcoin work and how doesn't it work and things like that. And people make up their own minds whether they want to try it out or not.
And since it's about Bitcoin, I would assume a lot of the reception has been shaky because people are biased one way or the other toward Bitcoin. And how is that shown in the criticism of your work? Is shown as a documentary itself, not necessarily being about Bitcoin? You mentioned earlier the Al Gore film. If someone was someone that didn't believe in global warming, they're going to say they're going to have a negative review regardless of how the film was made. Curious to see how that kind of works out for this movie.
Yeah, it's still a bit early for me because at the moment our audience is Bitcoiners, right? People that know about our film and they talk about it within the Bitcoin circles. But I am getting tweets and emails from people say, oh, I finally showed this film to my girlfriend or to my colleagues and they finally get it. So that is my hope, and that was always the goal, not to make a film for you or for me, to make a film for our friends and our colleagues who still don't understand what this Bitcoin thing is about. And yeah, hopefully that will work.
So we have a question from the audience, and I think this is a reasonable follow-up to what Tony just asked. And this question comes from Jim Linden. And do you think that there are industries or people working actively against Bitcoin or possibly getting paid to do so?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the astounding facts that I learned making this film is there's 5 lobbyists for every single Congress member for the financial industry, and I mean, they have to protect their turf and their sources of profits, and Bitcoin is one of those few threats for them. And I think that there was even a report that MasterCard.
All right, I think we lost our guest right now due to a connection problem, so give us 1 second. Let's try to get him back on the line. So far, this interview's been going great, so everyone that's watching live...
Lucky. You know, it's entirely possible that, you know, the powers that be have cut him off because they don't want him answering that question.
This is true. This is very true.
MasterCard caught on, didn't they?
Yeah, it was MasterCard. Yeah.
It seems too obvious, though. I mean, I would so obviously suspect that. It's really strange. I'm going to be reaching out to Torsten here, and we'll continue the discussion in the meantime. What do you all think of this question?
You know, personally, I've seen it. I know for a fact, you know, if there's someone like Torsten who is, out of the kindness of his own heart, basically working to produce this film, then there absolutely have to be people that are getting paid to do things either for or against it. And, you know, as we know in the industry, you know, we have jobs in the industry, you know, jobs relating to Bitcoin and the blockchain-related startups. There absolutely has to be people, part of the entrenched majorities, that are just being paid to prevent this from succeeding. And that's just the unfortunate reality.
I saw some movement. Are you back?
Okay, I think I'm back.
Good. Yes, we've got you. So I was just saying that it was very unfortunate that we lost you in the middle of that question in particular. So if you would, go ahead and resume.
Yeah, so there was this report that MasterCard has two lobbyists just to lobby against Bitcoin a year ago or so. Not sure whether that one is particularly true, but I'm absolutely sure that there's people working against Bitcoin at the moment. The lobby groups are just too powerful. The banks are just too rich and have too much money and too much political and regulatory capture. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So, Torsten, I was going to ask you, what kind of success have you seen for the documentary so far? Obviously, we have some opposition to Bitcoin, but it seems like challenges notwithstanding, the film's done quite well so far at film festivals and other events with a lot of Bitcoiners. Can you tell us a little bit about that, about the experience of promoting the film and the experience of the reception you've received?
Yeah, I'm very, very proud of the film festivals and the awards. Freedom Fest was our world premiere, and we won Best International Documentary and Best Libertarian Themes. So we're very proud of that. We've seen a very nice pickup in the Bitcoin crowd, and if you Google our name, you see Cointelegraph and all these articles. So we're quite pleased with that. I'm a little bit, let's say, disappointed still that we haven't really reached outside the Bitcoin crowd yet. And I think it will take time because people will tell their friends and then their friends. So I'm hoping that maybe the libertarian subculture, if you will pick up on the film a little bit more. And eventually, who knows, you know, maybe we will get a bit more traction on iTunes, on Amazon, once we are on those bigger platforms as well.
What steps do you have in mind, I guess, to kind of get outside of the libertarian, Bitcoiner, decentralization kind of sphere with this? Do you have any kind of steps in mind, or do you have, you really kind of want to focus on building the solid base here and then maybe try with future efforts in other spaces?
Well, this is the first time, so I'm learning every day, and maybe some of your listeners have some good ideas or press contacts or whatever ideas. Part of it is obviously my job is to license the film to the Netflixes and the television channels all around the world. And that's kind of my background. So I'm confident that I will get the film out there to at least some of my clients. But who knows? I honestly don't know.
And since, you know, you're claiming this is kind of your first project, or I don't know if it was your first, but this is a project, and it's also involving a separate part of your life. What exactly are your future projects? Are they also going to be documentaries? What are you looking toward next? Does it have anything to do with the tech space or something completely different?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, but I don't have an answer yet. So it's still too early days. I have to, you know, recoup the production budget, at least parts of it, and then think about the next steps. I would love to make a similar film again in the tech space because it's just something I'm passionate about. I'm a techie, you know, I like startups, but who knows? It might be something else. Maybe you guys have a good idea. Maybe it's a Bitcoin 2.0 applications that are coming out in the next couple of days that are super, super sexy. I don't know.
So you're talking a lot about recouping your costs, and you said that you've only been able to recover so far about 10%. And you're talking about licensing to the Netflixes, to the TV stations, hopefully. Is that your sole source of revenue? Because I see you're also sort of, you've chosen to distribute on BitTorrent, so I'd like to unwrap why you made the decision to do that. And then further, are there other mechanisms, like do you have a Bitcoin donation address that our listeners can donate to?
Yeah, so first, at the moment, yes, we only do pay VOD exploitation in the technical term. So we are on Vimeo On Demand. We are on the Protocol TV, where you can download or stream the film for Bitcoins. And we are on BitTorrent. But we are on BitTorrent Bundles, which is the pay service on BitTorrent. So it is a, I think, $7 download for the film plus a lot of bonus materials. So it's not we haven't actively encouraged piracy or the torrenting of the film. However, obviously, I do know that given the crowd and given our culture, that happens. I do hope that some of those donations end up in our wallet, but I haven't seen much of it. I've seen a few people trying to put up the entire film on YouTube, which I will flag, and this is at the moment obviously counterproductive to us making at least part of the production budgets back. So that's happening at the moment. Next step this week and next week is Amazon and iTunes, and then the next step is subscription VOD services like Netflix or television channels.
So Torsten, obviously you're making the film available for Bitcoin and on the protocol.tv is one of the sources for that, and you're using BitTorrent as well. What do you see as kind of the role of these technologies, of these decentralized and distributed technologies in the future of kind of content production and distribution? As a distributor yourself, do you think Bitcoin has a role in that?
Yeah, I love what the guys at the Protocol TV are doing, and they're super sharp, and they're like every little tweet or problem they work right on it, it's just awesome to work with a small agile company like that. And similarly, Streamium.io, we did a little test with them as well, small company in that space. I'm very hopeful, and I'm a technologist myself, and I like those kind of platforms. But I will say it's damn hard to create content platforms and or to replicate a Netflix, right? It takes 15 years and hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising budget. So it's tough, very, very tough. So I think at the moment the place for Bitcoin in that industry is just as a payment mechanism on some of these services. Maybe Vimeo will accept it. Maybe Amazon will accept it, but not really in the sense that you're thinking of, like a decentralized way to distribute content. Don't see it happening so soon, unfortunately.
Well, with that said, and you just went into a few different places viewers can see the movie, if there's any additional platforms that you forgot to mention, also there is a special for people that are listening to this, a promo code, and we wanted to give that out so you can go in with that. And how can our listeners find you and follow what you're doing and everything about the project online?
Yeah, first and foremost, so thanks for having us, and I'm talking about the film, so that's obviously a great platform for me to reach out to people. And as a little reward, we have a promo code for your listeners, and please put it on in the show notes. It's vimeo.com, and then you just search for Bitcoin and our film will show up. And when you rent or buy the film, there's a 20% discount code by just typing in decentralize, and it's all caps. Decentralize. No need to spell it, I guess.
Fantastic.
One more thing. And another thing is, we are independent filmmakers, and anything really helps. So I'm not asking for donations or anything, but if you can just give us a review on IMDb or like a thumbs up or like a little share or a little like or a little, Facebook, whatever, wherever you are, a tweet or whatever it is, it really helps us, because the Netflixes of these worlds, they are looking at does this film really have an audience? Is there really a story here? Do people care about this subject? And if I make a film that has 100 tweets and 10,000 followers, it will get taken more seriously than if I made a film about some topic that nobody cares about.
Well, Torsten, I think that this, I speak for all of us when I say that I think you've done a great thing for the overall Bitcoin community. Hopefully there will be many people educated by the film that you've produced. And we really appreciate you being able to join us on the show. And I think that personally, this may be one of the most seminal moments in deciding what the future of content distribution on the web looks like. So thank you again for joining us, Torsten.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Leeds. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.